Welcome back to the Roundtable. Dr. Monique Morris co-founded the National Black Women's Justice Institute, and she's the author of several books, including Push Out and Black Stats. In her highly anticipated book, Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, she invokes the spirit of the blues to articulate a radically healing and empowering pedagogy for black and brown girls. The book reimagines what education might be like if schools placed the thriving of black and brown girls at their center. Joe Donahue spoke with Dr. Monique Morris.
Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me on.
What brought about this project for you?
Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is an extension of a conversation that I've been having with communities across the country for about 4 years now. It is a project that follows my first book on this topic about school discipline and girls of color. It follows Push Out, the criminalization of black girls in schools. And so Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues came about really organically in the process of moving throughout communities, having discussions with folks, visiting schools, talking to girls and educators about what we might do to address the problem of school push out. And I wanted to share that in a new project. And that's what this is.
So basically, this reimagines what education could look like if the schools placed black and brown girls and they're thriving at the center of their curriculum.
Yes, and that is intentional because, you know, as I was suggesting in Push Out, black girls are the only group of girls who are experiencing exclusionary discipline at disproportionate rates, disproportionately high rates. The suspensions, expulsions, referrals to law enforcement, arrests on campus, and we have a growing number of brown girls, Latinas, indigenous girls who are also impacted by this condition. And so Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues is about thinking and really, you know, sort of strategically engaging the communities that are most impacted by these conditions and bringing them in closer rather than pushing them away.
Give us an example of some of the punishments and the impact that they have on the girls themselves.
Well, there are examples of girls. We actually had one emerge most recently where a 6-year-old girl was arrested for having a tantrum in her classroom in Florida. And, she's not the first one to experience this kind of condition or this kind of response to a normal childhood action, criminalization of that action by way of bringing in law enforcement to arrest her for having a tantrum in her classroom. But what we know is that, you know, young people who have contact with the juvenile court or criminal legal system at very early rates, certainly experience negative outcomes. They have a loss of instruction time. They have traumas associated with having had that contact and experience. Those are egregious cases, the ones that, you know, like the one I just shared. But there are also these everyday conditions where black girls and brown girls are being treated differently than their white counterparts for similar infractions. The speaking up and speaking out, asking questions, trying to take some agency in their education and in their learning, but instead are seen as sassy and combative, sometimes defiant. And so, you know, while the studies have continued to, track these issues and document these issues, there are many of us who are interested in the practice of how we respond to these conditions so that it doesn't just remain an academic exercise, but also, you know, really a fundamental practice in how we maintain educational justice for all of our girls.
How intentional is the punishment in the sense of if you ask those educators, would they realize what they're doing?
I don't think so. I think most educators come to the profession because they believe in the promise of children and adolescents and want to be part of a culture and community that is uplifting that. I think what happens is that there is a lack of opportunity for them to deeply explore their own biases, the implicit biases that inform how they engage with young people. And, you know, when I talk about this and I describe what Push Out is, I talk about it in terms of the policies, practices, conditions, and the prevailing consciousness that informs how young people are experiencing, discipline in schools that might render them vulnerable to contact with the juvenile court or criminal legal system. The hardest thing to tackle is the prevailing consciousness, what we think about our girls and how we are engaging with our girls, and whether we're seeing them as problem children or as intentionally defiant, or if we're recognizing all of the set of conditions that might be at the root of their behavior, so that if they are disruptive and an educator is trying to maintain order and, you know, trying to hold a classroom together, which is a very difficult job, they're inclined to be punitive as opposed to do what educators used to do, which is build out the relationship so that they can fundamentally respond to the core issues at hand. And what Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues does is document those schools that have shifted the narrative in many ways and intentionally explored the practices that do build out the relationships, that increase these, the opportunity for empathy and ways of engaging with young people, particularly those young people who are most at risk of school pushout, which are those young people who have experienced extraordinary traumas.
Besides the obvious, which is it's the right thing to do, what is the motivation for the schools to take on these practices?
Well, one thing is there's a benefit academically and in terms of academic achievement. The more students are engaged in their learning and feel safe enough to learn, the better they perform in school. You know, a lot of educators that I've had conversations with will say, I didn't get into this business to become a therapist. It's not necessarily my job to maintain safety. And my argument and really my invitation to educators is to see schools as an opportunity for healing so that they can become opportunities for learning. Young people learn best when they feel safe. And so it's really important to think about all of the ways in which young people can feel safe, not as an externally implemented structure or practice, but in the form of building out the relationships that can really transform a school community such that young people are not only feeling like they can be in community with each other, but that they can learn and perform better.
Even if the school has changed and things are better, I mean, one of the things you point out is there's still trauma that these children have that you have to overcome that as well.
Yeah, when I talk to young people, especially, you know, girls of color, black and brown girls, they will say with, you know, a great degree of, you know, force that they want their schools to be sanctuaries. They want their schools to be places where they don't have to endure sexual violence, where they don't have to be triggered if they are survivors of violence because there are adults surveilling their bodies, where they don't have to, you know, necessarily, you know, have conversations that are triggering of historical traumas because they're not included in the curriculum or that the curriculum itself is presenting a particular bias that they feel undermines their opportunity to learn and engage as scholars. So, you know, young people are asking for their schools to be, you know, what we know they can be, which is a safe place for them to learn, to feel supported, to be engaged. And I don't think that that is a tall, I don't think that's a big ask. I think that's an important part of what should be fundamentally how we see education in this society and how we practice it.
There's a point where you talk to a group of girls in Alabama and ask them to imagine school without police officers in them. They didn't take you up on that.
They
struggled to imagine that. What does that say?
Yeah, I think we have created a condition in our society where we've come to equate law enforcement with safety. And so when I ask the question for them to imagine what safety is and then to imagine their schools without law enforcement, they couldn't activate that radical imagination because so much has been ingrained in their being and in our culture, that in order for there to be safety, there must be guns present. And so the rhetoric of punishment has so deeply become a part of our discussions about accountability that it's conflating how young people can understand conditions of safety and the conditions of harm. But it's interesting, even in that same scenario, where after we had had this conversation and they struggled to imagine their schools without law enforcement, you know, I had conversations with them later, and the black and brown girls who were part of the discussion acknowledged that there were still some conditions in their community that made them not feel entirely safe with law enforcement just by virtue of them being law enforcement. They felt safe when there were adults around them who cared about them. Sometimes they were law enforcement officers, sometimes they were not. Most of the time they were not. But the things that made the officers most effective in the schools were not the fact that they were carrying a gun and a badge. The things that made them effective were the relationships that they were able to build with young people so that they could really talk to them about the real issues that were happening in their lives. And you don't necessarily need to be an officer to do that. You need to be a good youth development specialist, and you need to be a counselor in those ways. And so my argument and call to action is really to build out the skill sets that actually respond to the conditions that we say we want to correct, as opposed to just placing Band-Aids on them and saying everything is fine.
What are the parallels to how black and brown boys are being treated?
You know, I think there are many conditions that are shared. Certainly the surveillance is shared. Certainly the ways in which adultification impacts their capacity to be engaged. Adultification is the sort of way that we are framing the actions of adults that make and read the behaviors of young people to be more adult-like. For boys, that tends to be that they are perceived as more dangerous at earlier ages. It comes along with it a set of stereotypes that inform how adults understand and respond to boys as men when they shouldn't be. They should be seen as children. The punishment is harsh. The censure is immediate. We do also see the adultification occurring among girls, where girls are seen as are in need of less nurturing, less protection. This came from a study that Georgetown did recently on girls that found that black girls experience an adultification when they're as young as 5 years old, and that it peaks when they're between the ages of 10 and 14, which means that many of the adults that are interacting with our girls are also seeing them as more independent, and it can lead to them having less patience with them, again, leading to harsher punishment and immediate censure when they make a mistake. And so these are the conditions, you know, I think that they share. For girls, there's also an additional layer of the sexual violence and victimization that is a part of the culture that will basically say that it's okay for adults to come in and read the bodies of girls and interpret whether their bodies are appropriate for school and what they have on. And there's a reinforcement of some of the ideas about what constitutes a good girl or a not good girl or a bad girl if she's outspoken and loud and behaving in a way that people may say, you know, is okay for boys because boys will be boys. It's okay if they get a little disruptive. You know, boys will be boys. But if a girl is engaging in some of those externalizing factors, then she's immediately considered a problem, and the response can be quite harsh. And so, you know, I think fundamentally with all of our young people, we want to create schools that are responsive to who they are and that engage them in their learning. And there are schools that are doing that. This is, right. You know, something, you know, that's why I wrote about it in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, because a lot of times when I talk about these things, people will say, oh, that sounds good in a perfect world. And you know, my response to that is, you know, we don't live in a perfect world. And there are schools that are actually engaging and implementing these strategies and activities right now. And it doesn't require us to have a perfect world. It requires us to have our intentions to provide the best possible learning space for all children. That's what it requires.
I asked you what the motivation would be for schools to do this besides, as I said, doing the right thing. This doesn't cost anymore, right? I mean, this is just the treatment of people that should be a correct treatment of boys and girls, and regardless of their gender, regardless of their color.
Yeah, a lot of this is free. You know,
right.
I say that, you know, in many different places in the book. Like, this is free. This is about engaging. What may cost money, though, is, you know, sort of really building out the capacity of educators to recognize their own biases. So training costs money. We know that.
Sure.
We know that it costs, it's a reallocation of resources, really, in some ways, where we've spent a lot of money on in implementing the structures of surveillance and criminalization in schools, where we could spend that money on counselors. We could spend that money building out, you know, some of the volunteer structures and supporting the volunteers in a way that encourages them to continue to be a part of the school community. So it's about priorities in many ways, more so than about adding additional resources.
The name of the book is Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, Education for the Liberation of Black and Brown Girls. The book is published by The New Press. Monique Morris, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I so appreciate your conversation.
Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues. The book is published by The New Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.